You are listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Tuan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.
I'm here to read you some Roque Dalton poems by the great Salvadoran poet, born 1935, died 1975. Perhaps of his affection for communism, which didn't end up going so well because he was murdered by some other communists, one of whom is now in El Salvador's government. Nobody's ever gone on trial for the murder. And it's kind of a sore spot for his two surviving sons. He had three sons originally. One of them died fighting as a guerrilla. Roque was known for having a great sense of humor, being incredibly charming, kind of ugly, but very popular with the ladies. He was condemned to die twice in prison by the government of El Salvador. The first time there was a regime change, and the new regime let him out. And the second time he was in prison, and he just decided that he would almost pray. He sort of wanted to pray, but he was an atheist. So he said, "God, I know you don't exist, but it would be great if you could help me out in some way." And suddenly there was an earthquake, and the outer wall of his cell broke open, and he was able to walk out and join a passing religious procession that happened to be going by at that moment. Afterwards, he would have these conversations with his friend who left his priest, and a couple of other friends, and he would say, no, it wasn't God, it was just crazy luck. And so the priest then just, the inside joke was that the new name for God was crazy luck, suerte loco, suerte loca. So anywho, my involvement in this project came about because an Austrian director, and Tina Leisch did this amazing biography of Dalton, documentary of him. Spent a whole long time in El Salvador talking to everybody who knew him, and prison guards and prisoners and ordinary people who are very, very powerfully affected by his poetry. He's a kind of a hero, and at least among lefties in El Salvador. And one of his poems has become a kind of unofficial national anthem. Poema de Amor, if you Google Roque Dalton, R-O-Q-U-E, Dalton, D-A-L-T-O-N, and Poema de Amor, you can find it. If you happen to be in Austin, Texas, at the end of April 2014, the film is getting presented at the Latin American Film Festival in Austin. Yeah, he was finally, he lived in El Salvador, he studied in Chile and Mexico, studied some mythology and culture and history and things like that. He was the first important poet to use swear words and slang, very typical expressions like that in his poetry. So Tina hired me to do English subtitles for her film, and then about a month ago, she called me up again and said, "Hey, can you do some more poetry translation so we can make a little booklet for the DVD?" So I started translating a few more poems. And here we have a couple of them. Well, let's say a few of them. This one is the unofficial national anthem of at least lefties in El Salvador. Love poem. The ones who expanded the Panama Canal and were paid in silver, never gold, who repaired the Pacific Fleet in the bases of California, who rotted in prisons in Guatemala, Mexico, Honduras, and Nicaragua, for stealing, for smuggling, for swindling, for being hungry. The ones suspected of everything, who filled the bars and brothels of every port and capital of the region, Blue Grotto, Panties, Happy Land, who planted corn deep in foreign jungles, the kings of the crime page. Where they come from, nobody knows. the best artisans in the world, who were sown by bullets when they crossed the border, who died of malaria or scorpion stings or snake bite in banana plantation hell, who got drunk and wept at the national anthem under the Pacific cyclone or the snows of the north. The scroungers, the beggars, the potheads, the Salvadoran sons of bitches, the ones who barely made it back home, the ones who were a little luckier, the ones who never have their papers, who make anything, who sell anything, who eat anything, the first to whip out a knife, the saddest of the sad of the world, my countrymen, my brothers. This one is called To Dry Your Tears. As the killer returns to the scene of the crime to notice the corpse's last panorama, as spring returns from the jaws of winter with life in the hands of an unfinished blossom, as the blind man's dog returns after being smacked with its bones open to the light of a crust of bread, as night returns with its new blacknesses, leaving the day broken with its spears of ice, as the most prodigal son returns from the streets to the quiet table and the old aromas, wounded with the broadest and most navigable wound, thirsting with the thirst most daughter of the sand, so I return to you. This is this next one is called My Girl, My Woman. It's actually the last part of this poem. I just happen to have it stuck in here in this particular word file. My girl, my woman, my great symbol of peace, my little corral, my number one witness, my stealthy teacher. From your secret smile, you attack my fears. My daily water, you give me a harvest to wash all the world's thirst. My flag of meat, my great vein, I tell you that I love you as I never loved before, as no one ever loved you or will love you. Haughty, clear, painful, from all my happy trees, from all my pores, from my secrecy and my walls, from the exact tears, face to face, that only you, angel of the new heaven I build, know me. I love you. In you I establish my right to love above all things. There's a story behind that. The woman that he wrote that for us is in the film. She says she was 14 when she met him. He was 23. His father brought her to an event at which there were communists, poets, I'm not sure, but he said he had to go see that guy standing over there, Roque Dalton. She saw this guy just laughing like crazy. She thought it was utterly wonderful and fell in love with him. And she said that people criticized him for being involved with her, but she says it was she that seduced him. They met between 6 and 8 in the evenings. After his job and before he went home to his wife and kids, he was 23 at the time. One of his friends was interviewed on the phone and said, "I don't know how he does it. I don't know how he did it. He's this crazy literary guy, and he's a communist, very hardworking organizer, and all that. At the same time, he had a family life. So very, very busy and intelligent and learned guy." Anywho, this one here is called About Headaches. It's beautiful to be a communist, but it gives you a lot of headaches. And the communist headache is supposed to be historical. In other words, it doesn't submit to analgesic tablets, but only to the embodiment of paradise and earth. That's how it is. Under capitalism, we have a headache, and we rip our heads off. In the fight for the revolution, the head is a time bomb. As we construct socialism, we plan for headaches, which doesn't decrease the frequency quite the opposite. Communism will be, among other things, an aspirin the size of the sun. Next bit is just a fragment I translated from an essay that somebody wrote about him, about his poetry. And the person who wrote the essay quotes him also as saying, to understand my poetry, you have to understand my life. Because what he was kind of writing as on the run as an activist, he never had much downtime. He was always one place or another. Mexico, Cuba, Prague, Vienna. He was in Vienna briefly to renew with his sons to renew his passport. This is from a time, this is a piece from the time when he was in Mexico studying Aztec and Maya mythology. And it's called The Restoration of Man by Quetzalcoatl. In fact, it was very difficult to create man. In their enthusiasm, the gods tasted failure many times, and many times they destroyed their work with enraged hands. The men of clay, the men of wood, the men eaten by the jaguar, the ones chased by a wind that turned them into monkeys, the ones burned by a rain of fire, these were very small children. The ones who perished when the sky flooded, when the sky turned to water and crashed down on the men of corn. They hadn't given satisfaction to the former giver of being. They hadn't been truly grateful. Oh, heart of green air, sad were the skies without mirrors, without the mirrors of the eyes of man. Oh, heart of sea petals. Later, Quetzalcoatl went down to Mictlan, the land of the dead. He went to Mictlantecuhtli and Mictlansihuatl, the lovers, the master and mistress of the shadows. I come in search of the precious bones, he said. The precious bones you're guarding. I come to take them. That's why I'm here. Mictlantecuhtli said, what for? What will you do with them, Quetzalcoatl? And he responded, of them will be made the durable men, the men who will be truthful even when they doubt themselves, the ones who won't be dead before being awakened by the rage of the gods at their own failure. They will live on the earth. The gods, I tell you, are worried that someone will live horribly naked on the earth. Mictlantecuhtli's eyes shone. All right, he said, but first blow a note on this conch shell trumpet and walk four times around this beautiful circle. Try it, he added to himself. It's impossible. That conch shell has no holes. It's deaf and dumb. He laughed. The Quetzalcoatl summoned some insect larvae and some bumblebees, both with eyes of dull topaz. And the first drilled some holes, and the second entered the conch shell and made it resound. When he heard the arpeggio, Mictlantecuhtli said, fine, take the bones. But to his people, he said, tell Quetzalcoatl that he has to leave them. Tell the gods that he can't take away our preciousness. Oh, stolen heart, sorrow built a nest like a mortal bird, forever alone, solitude, the pallid void, just a trace of loss in the violated pupil of the eye. Oh, heart of thirst, O son of the ruins, born in nakedness among the rough hands of humiliation. Our warrior father felt the danger in the pores of his skin. He consulted his nahual, his spirit double, and went to fetch the bones. The bones of a man and woman were together. The nahual picked them up and made a bundle of them. But the gods had dug a sinister hole, a pit, a crater the size of cholera, to hinder the flight of the preciousness of their children. Into it fell Quetzalcoatl among the quails of Mictlan. Into it he collapsed, he dropped dead. The precious bones were scattered, and the quails gnawed on the bones that could not weep, the bones of man and woman. Until Quetzalcoatl came back to life, until Quetzalcoatl turned back to the sea of life. And gathering up the bones, he went like the breeze to Tamuanchan. That's where we came down from. His nahual protesting because the sweat of its fear had not yet dried. Afterwards, the preciousness was finally ground and placed in a clay pot no less precious by Sihuacoatl, the swordfish snake, and Quilashti, the seed of greenery. Quetzalcoatl, above the bones, above the dust of them, bled his slender member like a magnificent dying animal, and he made penitence for the germination. Apantecuhtli, the lord of the canal, the river dweller. Huitlolinki, the lord of the moving shovel, who works the planting stick. Tepanquisqui, who represents the standard bearer. Tlalamanac, who holds up the earth. And Sontimoc, who descends head first. The gods, they all made penitence until the miracle took place. The miracle that had taken so long. And then they said to each other, the humans are born, O gods, the humans we've deserved through our penitence. For them, we, the all-powerful, have suffered infinitely. May there be joy among us. Now we are complete because we have someone to name us, someone to believe in us, someone to pray to us. Joy, joy, your heart rescued from the night, violent pupil of the greatest lion, drowned in glasses of wealth, now and forever initiated in the victory of the light. O heart of the stone fountain in the lap of wonder, joy, joy, nudity is the most beautiful fruit. And this next one is called from the history. It's a selection from a longer poem called "The History of a Love," and it's a kind of a dialogue poem between him and his Czech girlfriend. One Thursday, she said, "Socialism, it's not bad. Even the poorest have toasters, TVs, French stockings, good shoes, better pots, clothes that just went out of style in Paris, paid vacations, refrigerators, serious dreams with a small car for next spring, dignified visits to the Office of Foreign Tourism. The only bad thing is that everything is better in West Germany. Haven't you heard about the electric carving knives, the LSD chewing gum, the powdered wine, the condoms with op art designs? As a proletarian poet, you have the right to satirize. But go easy on the lady who so lovingly strips for you, living on great swigs of morality, served in glasses of political economy." This one is called "No, I Wasn't Always This Ugly." This is the penultimate one. I'll read three more. So this is the third from last. "No, I wasn't always this ugly. The thing is, a Costa Rican guy named Lisano broke my nose with a brick because I said it was obviously a penalty, and he said, 'No, no, no.' I'll never again turn my back on a Costa Rican soccer player. Father Archirandio nearly died of fright because in the end there was more blood than on an Aztec altar. And then Quique Soler hit me in the right eye with the most accurate stone imaginable. We were playing Battle of Okinawa, and my retina ruptured. This meant 1 month of absolute immobility at the age of 11. I visited Dr. Quevedo in Guatemala, and Dr. Bidford, who wore a red toupee. Ever since then, I squint sometimes, and after a movie, I look like a junkie exposed. The other reason was a bottle of rum that Maria Elena's husband threw at me. I really wasn't thinking of doing anything bad, but every husband is a world of his own. And when we recall it, he thought I was an Argentinian diplomat, and we must give thanks to God. The other time was in Prague. Four criminals kicked the shit out of me in a dark alley, 2 blocks from the Ministry of Defense, 4 blocks from the police station. It was the eve of the opening of the Party Congress, so someone said it was a protest against the Congress. In the hospital, I met 2 other delegates who had come through their own assaults with multiple fractures. Someone else said the CIA was behind it, paying me back for escaping from jail. Others told me it was an example of racism against Latin Americans, and others of the universal urge to steal. Comrade Sobolev came by to ask if I had touched the ass of an accompanied lady before protesting at the Ministry of the Interior in the name of the Soviet Party. Ultimately, we never learned why I was assaulted. In any case, and to sustain what interests me here, the results were a double fracture of the lower jaw, a severe concussion, 1.5 months in hospital, and 2 months of eating everything in liquid form, even steaks. The last time I was in Cuba, I was clambering down a hillside in the rain with an M52 in my hands, and a bull appeared out of nowhere. My feet got caught in the underbrush, and I began to fall. The bull passed over me, and because he was a lazy bastard, he didn't come back and gore me. But anyway, that wasn't necessary, because as I've been telling you, I fell on top of the gun, which rebounded like a revolution in Africa, and broke in 3 pieces my zygomatic arch, very important for the aesthetic resolution of the cheekbones. This explains at least part of my problem." This one is called "Life, Crafts." "Forever unavoidable, new life dawns within me. It's a small sun with roots. I'll have to water it a lot and encourage it to play at fighting corruption. Small poor bread of solidarity, flag against the cold, fresh water for the blood,
maternal elements that should not stray from the heart. And against melancholy, trust. Against despair, the voice of the people vibrating in the windows of this secret house. To discover, to decipher, to articulate, to set into motion old crafts of the liberators and martyrs, which are now our obligations, and which are out there telling us the steps, from breakfast to sleep, from stealth to stealth, from action to action, from life to life. And the last one is called In the Small Hours of the Night. When you hear that I've died, don't say my name. It would hinder death and rest. Your voice is the bell of my five senses, the dim lighthouse that my fog would seek. When you learn of my death, say strange syllables. Say flower, bee, tear, bread, storm. Don't let your lips find my 11 letters. I'm tired. I've loved. I've earned the silence. Don't say my name when you learn of my death. From the dark earth I would come through your voice. But don't say my name. Don't say my name. When you learn that I'm dead, don't say my name.
You are listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Tuan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.
In Vienna, from in kind of a loose sense, with visitations from the Nighttime Daydreams manuscript. The Yahe had gotten rid of most of my back pain. I'd worked hard for the cure, and the cure had worked hard for me. As far as my teacher was concerned, I'd done well to keep up. You drank, he said, like people used to drink in the old days. But he indicated I'd been a little dense for not having seen the sky people that Lázaro danced with. The next ceremony was just the two of us, Joaquin in one hammock, I in another. He poured a cup of yahe for himself, prayed over it, drank it, poured a cup for me, prayed over it, and gave it to me. I welcomed it, drank it, welcomed it again, hummed a tune for it, felt its cool presence in me. Don Joaquin went to sleep. I went over some of the events of the past week, repeated them to myself, related them to other events, registering them in my memory while waiting for the yahe to come on. One afternoon I was sitting with my back against one of the posts of Cabaña Supernatura, reading a Spanish-language comic book version of Dante's Divine Comedy. My dictionary was next to me. While the poet was wending his way through the inferno, I was looking up Spanish verbs that meant things like to groan, to wail, to gnash one's teeth. Nearby, Luis, Xiomara, and Macias were wandering around with their father's blowgun. Bored with devils, I paged ahead to the angels, graceful, robed, and sparkling spheres of light, and wondering what the relationship was between them and the sky people the Sequoias saw. The same thing in different forms? Different species or tribes? Were they all imaginary, as my mom would say? I heard a pfft, and out of the corner of my eye saw something fall. Had the kids hit a bird? Trailed by his siblings, Luis strode over to me, bearing dart and prey, a brown and gold butterfly, pierced through one wing, through the abdomen, and through the other wing. I put down the Divine Comedy as he handed me this living, low-fat shish kebab, this skewered little angel. I tried to telepathically communicate with the insect, telling it to let go of its pain and enter the other world, but as soon as I did so, it started beating its wings like mad. I held the fuzzy abdomen gently and worked the dart out by carefully twisting and pulling. The butterfly fluttered away unsteadily and soon became lost among the trees. As I handed the dart back, Luis laughed, not unkindly, at the expression on my face. I remembered then that in Waurani territory I'd wanted to learn to use the blowgun. A year later, having calculated how long it would take me to become proficient, I chose to spend my free time reading and writing. I figured out that I wasn't a hunter, and I'd basically given up on my dream of leading the indigenous people in a rebellion. Frankly, I wasn't impressing them as much as I had hoped. But they had accepted me as a companion, and the reality of that was more satisfying than the fantasy had been. In spite of the Paca incident, rocking back and forth in the dimness, as the Ahe begins to come on, I see again the Paca springing past me, the big brown tasty rodent that Joaquin and I were hunting. The two dogs had chased it, and it had sprinted toward me and streaked past in a blur. I could have struck it with my machete, but in that moment I felt sorry for it. It vanished into its burrow. For the next 3/4 of an hour, Joaquin sat stone-faced on a log and supervised me in the task of carrying water from a nearby stream in one of his rubber boots and pouring it, bootful by bootful, into the hole. I found killing was easier when it was a matter of doing it slowly and following orders. From the surface, I could hear the animal as it snarled, then gurgled, then fell silent. The time was 5:30. We started to dig down to the corpse through the clayey earth with our machetes, but then it was time to leave so we could be home before dark. I'd read somewhere that rainforest women scorn unsuccessful hunters by refusing to look directly at them, and when we got back and Joaquin told the story to Maribel and Xiomara, I found it was true. Only on the following day, once we'd gone back with a shovel and dug out the wet furry corpse and brought it back to the hut, was I no longer treated as an invisible non-entity. When I was a small child, a friend stomped on an anthill and invited me to join in killing the frantic ants that scuttled this way and that. I refused, imagining that there might be powers that stood in the same relationship to me as I stood to the ants. In being merciful, I sought to deserve these powers' mercy as well. From then on, I've treated live animals as I've hoped to be treated. So even as an adult, I'm useless as a hunter. But can I be a healer? Joaquin has told me that each night that one drinks yahe is called a house, and that once I've drunk 15 houses of yahe, I'll be able to cure any illness. This house is number 4. Any illness? I wonder, as multicolored lights wink on in the darkness, and my body becomes flexible and diffuse. Even AIDS and cancer? I doubt it, but I'm willing to try. Joaquin remarked in another conversation that he didn't know if I'd be able to turn into a jaguar because I'm so tall. They having jaguar tunics in their house that they're giving people to put on, he explained. I don't know if they having one big enough for you. He seemed serious about this. Now, amid the gathering of the multicolored lights of the soul, I remember I used to want to shapeshift when I was a teenager, and I concluded then that I'd have to die before I could do so. Tonight, I still doubt I could shapeshift, but as with the healing, I'm willing to try. The transformation that's inevitable is death. I imagine how much damage my body could sustain before dying. I wonder if the thought is a premonition that one day I'll die under torture. I wonder what it would take to get me to kill someone else. Old superstitions about death suddenly make sense. The forces of nature get hungry, like everything else. So Aztecs fed hearts to the sun. Celts sliced open bellies, wrapped intestines around trees, burned people in wicker cages. Earlier this very year in Rwanda, the earth thirsted for blood and drove Hutus to kill 1 million Tutsis. I revisit my strange equation. The more pain before death, the more pleasure after. Nezahualcoyotl's story about the sun dance comes back, how his unspeakable pain bloomed into ecstasy. I see again before my eyes Bishop Labaka, speared by the Tagaeris, his face peaceful, his lips parted in a soft smile. I ponder the bloody history of Europe. Cultures have always needed to make war and alliances and more war to avoid being conquered by whoever's in the next valley, city, state, nation. It's clear now that it's all movements of energy, creating, destroying, rebuilding themselves in larger and stronger forms and structures. The less vital are constantly being killed by the more vital, maximizing vitality in the world of the living. Violence is the fastest way to move energy and break down outmoded forms. And groups that are sworn enemies in one cycle of time can become allies in the next. The French and the British, for instance, they're friends now. That brings me back to my personal life. After my parents split up, my mom taught me that my dad was evil, banal, foolish. I believed that for years. Her hatred ebbed after I swallowed all those aspirins and got sent home from boarding school, because she found herself side by side with him, trying to rescue me from the family demons. In fact, one of my motivations for making the suicidal gesture had been to try to end some of that hatred. Later, when my mom and Walter split, she admitted that my dad had always been a pretty decent guy after all. He'd always paid his child support on time, and when money was needed for anything else, he came up with it. So anyone in the world can be a friend or enemy. It depends on the circumstances and how the players play it. It's like what Nezahualcoyotl said about the snake, a friend to some and an enemy to others. The monotheists recoiled, but the shamans were down with him. Mr. Snakely Earth Wisdom, Atandi, our old evil good friend enemy. Christianity and science agree that he once had legs and then lost them. Was that a curse, a blessing, or both? The fruit of the tree of knowledge must have been psychedelic, that's obvious. Why does knowledge grow on trees? And what do snakes know about that? The myth of Adam and Eve is based on a true story. It could be 80,000 years old, passed from mouth to ear. They were the forest-dwelling ancestors of people who later became known as Hebrews. The drug took effect, and the snake told them it was time to develop and follow the special path of humanity. "Rise up, humans," he said. "There's a way of knowledge and a destiny. You're greater than apes." But God said to them, "You blew it, you arrogant fools. You woke up from the animal dream. But if you want to reach the sky, you can work for it and suffer till you get there." To Adam, he said, "You'll work for a million years and then some before you'll deserve to live in my heaven." Eve, he cursed with pain in childbirth. And the cursing of women with pain in childbirth goes back to the time when we were all deciding to walk upright. It's a trade-off. The bones realign. The pelvis closes up somewhat. So you see, it's a very old story. Like the stories of heaven and hell. Mystics had visions of people in hell and thought the punishment was eternal. But it's being shown to me now that all that agonizing burning is no more and no less than the generation of heat and power for the earth. Sin becomes a substance in the soul, thick, heavy, sticky, that burns like oil. Sin is necessary. It's what the earth machine runs on. And once all that sin burns off, the soul's light and free. Psalm 49 again. "Why need I fear when evil times come? Only my own sins can ensnare me." Part 2. The night becomes gloomier than before. Denser clouds pass under the moon. The crickets seem to mourn, saying that we're all ensnared in our sins from the moment we're born. I catch sight of a vision I don't like. In the open space between Cabaña Supernatura and the smaller hut where Rufino and his family are sleeping, a semi-transparent, glowing red devil is dancing in place. He has goat legs and he's grinning. He's not looking at me, but I can tell he's aware I'm looking at him. I force myself to look away. I scold my mind for having conjured this hallucination. Okay, he must be gone now, I think. But when I look back, he's still dancing there. Damn. It's like Pata said, "I drank yahe and a devil came." I look away again. Perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, midway between the devil and me is a plant the Sequoias call Nuni, which Joaquin has told me has the power to repel the devil. This is oddly reassuring. The next time I look, the apparition has vanished. The clouds thin out again. The dark world undims. Joaquin wakes and begins to sing, the ahe's synesthetic properties converting his rich voice into insanely detailed, brilliantly colored abstract images. He pauses and murmurs, "See, there they are." I open my eyes and look where he's pointing, the peak of the hut's roof. I'm delighted to see the calves and sandaled feet of three women, angels. They rise slowly through the ceiling and vanish, ascending to heaven. Joaquin sings again and sleeps. I wonder what it was like for Dante to look into his imagination and see the contents of his poem. Did he experience himself as assembling it like a craftsman? Or did it come as a revelation? Off to my right, I hear the mellifluous buzz of an approaching insect. The sound synesthesizes into a path of brightly colored rectangles that enters my vision from the right side. As it crosses my face, the sound path splits apart and multiplies to portray something like a multicolored mosaic spacecraft, before narrowing again on the left side into a single path of rectangles reaching away. In the same instant, a question pops into my head. What makes the crow fly delirious with cunning? I contemplate the persistent image of this mosaic spacecraft. And did the insect just drop that question on me? I whisper it over and over to memorize it. I remember a fairy tale collected by the Grimm brothers in which crows had visions of the future. That would make someone delirious with cunning. Like La Baca, he and Sister Arango must have been in cahoots with the Tagairis. They knew they could ransom them with their lives. Typical Christian missionaries valuing the next world more than this one. Cunning as crows, they walked into heaven with open eyes. They didn't have children, which made it easier to die. They knew that if one wants to exercise influence over a piece of land, one can bleed into it. Their bodies were riddled with holes. Their blood drained into the ground. The earth drank their sacrifice and empowered their prayers. The oil companies stayed off the land. Little by little, other lines congeal, and a poem is born. What makes the crow fly delirious with cunning, with the cat flash of a many-fingered tornado? The world is a riddle, riddled with riddles. Day creates, night destroys. Night creates, day destroys. We defend the forest with open arms. Openly armed, we defend the forest. Off in the distance, howler monkeys roar their own endless poem. Nearby, a rooster calls out that dawn will come soon. The sleepers are stirring. I wrap up in my blanket to warm my shoulders, turn onto my right side, feel the sway of the hammock, touch the taut strings, recite the lines of the poem again so I'll remember it, go over the content of the night's waking dreams, and watch dawn ease into the forest. A couple hours later, a guide brought seven French tourists to visit the shaman. They ranged in age from about 25 to 60. Still in my green tunic and smudged face paint, I arranged benches for everyone to sit on. The visitors' light skin and hair and their European features comforted me. I haven't been around anyone but sequoias for a couple weeks, I remarked in English. It's nice to see some familiar faces. They smiled warmly. Joaquin smiled too. Their guide had to go down to the river to tinker with the canoe's motor, so I interpreted as they talked with Joaquin. A woman asked a question. I translated it into Spanish. Joaquin exclaimed, "Ah," and answered a slightly different question. I translated his response into English without comment. "No," she said, "I meant," and repeated her question. I translated her words into Spanish for Joaquin again. He said, "Ah," again, and answered a similar but still different question. His discourse, interspersed with my translations, he went on at such length and in such detail that the woman forgot her original question. In the afterglow of the ahe, the multicolored beaded band of the Uncucuy's crown was splendorous. like something the Weenuwai might wear, like the brilliant skin of the rainbow serpent, like celestial static, a translation into beads of some high energy that went through his mind while he was making it, a nano version of the crown of God. Forcing my gaze away from the crown, I noticed the oldest tourist eyeing me critically. The man clearly suspected Joaquin and I were somewhat under the influence of this wonder drug we were touting. I looked him in the eye and nodded, yes, before translating Joaquin's latest comment. In the old days, during the summertime of August, September, and October, people would pack their finest clothes and ceremonial gear and trek for weeks to come to the Ahe Lodge for healing and visions. Then the clay trumpet would sound to announce that the ceremony was going to begin. The tourists were fascinated by Joaquin's account of the tradition. The youngest looked like he would have liked to stay with us and drink. In the late afternoon, as we were weeding the patio garden, Joaquin remarked, "The devil was here last night, wasn't he?" My jaw dropped. "I guess so." "He was dancing right over there, wasn't he?" "I guess so," I repeated, stunned. He seemed to have seen just the same figure as I had, but his interpretation differed slightly. I didn't understood the figure as a devil, whereas he'd called it the devil. In any case, the episode reinforced my conviction that the energies we were working with were real. It was impossible for me to believe that Joaquin hadn't somehow seen the same vision that I'd seen, and I wanted to learn how he had done it.
You are listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Tuan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. Green Jaguar, from the manuscript of Nighttime Daydreams. Heading into my final ceremony of 1994, I felt I was getting pretty good at drinking Yahe, and my surroundings were accepting me. I'd woken once in the middle of the night and seen through my mosquito net a lit firefly directly above my head, unblinkingly tracing a long, looping noodle of light. For this ceremony, Joaquin and I were joined by three French people, a married couple who organized tours, and an aspiring photojournalist. Frederick and Claire Fillon knew Fred from... Frederick and Claire Fillon knew Joaquin from previous visits with tourists. They lived on the coast. They had been trying to conceive a child. It hadn't worked so far. They thought a ceremony with Joaquin might help. The photojournalist, Raoul Savoy, was here because his mother had been here with Fred and Claire and had suggested to him that he document a Yahe ceremony. Raoul, though, wasn't convinced by any of this, not by the beauty of the rainforest, nor by Frederick's enthusiasm, nor by Joaquin, and he couldn't decide if he wanted to drink with us or not. So when the time came to brew the Yahe and he asked to come along to take pictures, Joaquin answered flatly, "No, that isn't possible." After some discussion, Claire and Raoul stayed at the hut while nearby Joaquin and I brewed the Yahe as Frederick snapped photos of us, my teacher in his red tunic and me in my green one. After the vines and leaves had boiled for a couple of hours, I asked Joaquin if I could sample the brew. He nodded and I drank a cup. Before long, the sounds of the forest acquire a peculiar intimacy, as if they are taking place inside my head. A nearby tree hosts a colony of black and yellow Orapendula birds. A couple dozen nests like great brown teardrops hang from the branches. The inconceivably weird and lovely calls of the birds tug my mind skyward. "Stekekekekekeo," they cry. "Bloop!" They are sky spirits in physical form, like the fireflies I've been seeing, like the leaf fans that Joaquin uses. "They help with shamanism, right?" I ask Joaquin, unsure how to formulate the question. Frederick smiles and leans in to listen. "Huh-huh." Joaquin nods, smiling, his voice gentle and high-pitched, as if speaking to a small child. "Umu," he adds. "That's what we calling them in Painkuka." "Umu," I repeat, tasting the black and yellow syllables on my tongue. "Umu," echoes Frederick contentedly. "Stekekekekekeo," bloop, proclaims an umu. I feel blissfully jaguarish and bare my teeth at the forest. I hiss, curling my lips back, practicing the glare. My hands describe paw movements in the air. Joaquin chuckles and says, Yai Wahe. I smile my human smile, receiving the name. I know Yai means jaguar and Wahe means young, fresh, green. I bare my teeth again, wanting to growl. The human invites me, the quasi-jaguar, to sit with my back to a tree. With his leaf fan, he whisks off the front of my body, including the area over my crotch. I feel what a lot of stress I'm carrying there. The leaf fan is working on it like a broom sweeping a mound of dirt. I sigh, breathe deeply, think, Oh, Christ, just let it go. I'm in my healing place, I breathe, on my healing plane. When Joaquin finishes, he works on Frederick in the same way. Feeling cleaner now, I curl my emerald felid self up on the ground and listen to the sh-sh-sh-sh-sh-sh of Joaquin's Mami Coco or leaf fan and the zzzz of cicadas and the stekekekekeo bloop of the umu birds. Rap, they add, zooming around with a choom of feathers, blurting whoop. The calls of birds, I think wordlessly, serve not only to identify each species and establish territory, but also to convey traditional and contemporary observations. In their calls, the Oropendulas encode information for humans who can hear it. Though the information is hard to translate into human terms, they are teachers. They sing their vision into us. I can feel it changing me as I lie here. After I come down, Frederick and I got to talking. He said, We were at the school in Siacoya this morning, and Luis and I were talking about you. I said something about that tourist, and Luis corrected me. No, he's not a tourist. He lives with us. That's how it is, I said, pleased and unsurprised. Luis has a way of making me feel at home here. Check this out. One day my legs itched all the way from my ankles up to where my underwear began. I didn't know why. I took a swim. When I got out, Luis saw me scratching. He called me over to where he and Macias and another boy were playing. They inspected my legs closely. He was like, You have matsika. He showed me these tiny red specks. Chiggers, they're called in English. My legs were covered with them. The three boys immediately broke slivers off the bamboo lattice at the edge of the floor of Cabaña Supernatura and got to work removing the matsika one by one as I stood there. It took 10 minutes and then the problem was gone. I was thinking, these indigenous people are smart. They really know how to live. That's right, commented Fred. We have a lot we can learn from them. I went on. Another day, I was sitting at the dining table feeling low, and Luis came over and massaged my shoulders. The indigenous people are really cool that way. I hung out with Guaranis last year. They were really cuddly with each other and with me. I think a side effect of civilization is that it increases people's physical distance from one another. This must be why we're so neurotic about being touched. Humans evolved in the past when we had a lot of non-sexual touching, and now we're not getting it so much anymore. If you get chiggers in Sequoia culture, kids pick them off you. If you get chiggers in my culture, you go to a store and buy a chemical to swab onto your skin. It's a trade-off. Fred nodded. Chemicals, he said. For us, it's all about chemicals. One day, I said, the family stopped setting a place for me and serving me separately. They invited me to share the piranha soup and yuca flatbread with them on that low palm slat platform behind Cabaña Supernatura. Since then, they've treated me like one of the family. You're lucky you have these people, Fred said. When the ahe had gotten thick enough, like honey, Joaquin said, we took it off the fire and let it cool. Then we made our way back to the cabin. Raul let us know he'd decided to go ahead and drink. Three hammocks were hung, forming three sides of a square. Fred and Claire reclined in one, Joaquin in another, and I in the third. Raul sat near his sleeping bag and backpack at the base of the house post where Joaquin's hammock met Fred and Claire's. In the dark, as the ahe comes on, I tremble. The three French people remind me of my college semester in Paris, which reminds me of the Middle Ages. I whistle a sprightly medieval tune. The ahe I drank is a skittish white unicorn on a green field. With my music, I try to convince it not to jab me with its horn, and ultimately to exit by the back way rather than dash out the front. But that's tough because I'm not so calm myself. Meanwhile, Frederick softly sings for his unconceived child, pale gray fern fronds curling up from his lips. I sit up. Joaquin is chanting over the plastic jug of yahe. Tiny demons are flowing off the surface of the jug like dust particles. I can't tell if I'm perceiving or imagining them. I formulate, little demons can hide anywhere and get inside us if we're not careful, and that's why it's good to pray over anything we're getting ready to ingest. Joaquin pours the liquid into a cup for himself and drinks it. He asks me if I want more. I do. He pours and hands it to me, and I drink most of it and instantly throw it up on the floor. What happened? My teacher asks, a little cross. I don't know, I gulp. The unicorn must have leapt out. I drink what's left, lie back, soak it into my body mind. The air thickens. You can feel it in your soul, I pun. As Joaquin sings, the feel it in my soul comes back. Yaiwahe, green jaguar, enters the lower half of my face first. My jaw tenses, my lips curl back in a snarl. Under my hammock, the fingers of my right hand curl into claws and rake a wooden floorboard. Is the jaguar energy really something from outside me? A part of me wonders. Or am I acting it, performing it? Is it something I've taken in bit by bit through my senses over the years, every time I've seen a picture of a jaguar, and it's only now being realized? The yai effect ebbs. Over the next few minutes, I slide backwards, inch by inch, out of the hammock onto the floor, until only my feet, in green wool socks, are resting in it, on the floor near Joaquin's hammock. The kerosene lamp's soft yellow flicker takes me back to a winter evening when I was 5 years old. My newly single artist father was entertaining the three neighbor kids and me with the powers of light. He was 34. His losing custody battle over me was in its final stages. By day, in a courtroom, he was having his psychology publicly vivisected by my mother and stepfather and their allies. But this evening he was buoyant, visionary. We were in the living room with the electric lights off. He had a lit candle, a prism, and a magnifying glass. He interposed the glass objects between the flame and the white wall and slowly moved them this way and that to change the shape, color, and intensity of the blob of light on the wall. We kids were mesmerized by the brilliant transformations. Lastly, my father made shadow animals with his hands and spoke in their voices. The finale was a droll conversation between two camels in the desert. Lying on my back on the floor, I stretched the hammock between my feet to make a screen, and with the hands my parents gave me and the light from my teacher's lamp, I silently reenact the camel's conversation. Who did my dad learn this routine from? The lineage of it might go back to the ancient Hebrews, and it was always a younger camel talking with an older camel, who had talked with a still older camel, and so on, stretching back to a vanishing point where Adonai Eloheinu created camels out of divine language. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has created camels. At this moment flares a brightness of blazing intensity, as if the sun has exploded. Raoul has taken a flash photo of me. I laugh at the incongruity. Here I am deep in a trance, and there's this brusque intrusion of normalcy from outside. But I like Raoul, and I want to help him. It would be great for his project if he could get a photo of me making the jaguar face. I decide to turn over and look at him and do it. As I turn over, though, the yai energy takes over with mad force and apparently decides to punish him for his impudence. I roar at him, baring my teeth, roar again while he shrinks back, gripping his camera against one of the broad posts that hold up the roof of the hut. I pound on the floor of the hut as if on a giant drum. A roar, my feet tranquilly resting on the hammock in nominal obedience to Joaquin's injunction that I remain in my hammock for the duration of the ceremony. I pound and roar. Soon, a tiny analytical part of me notices that one sound I'm roaring is hum-ba-ba-bum, which contains the name of Humbaba, the demon from the Sumerian myth, the guardian of the cedar forest, the one Gilgamesh and Enkidu killed, the enemy of civilization who had to be eliminated so the forest could be logged and the city built up. I figure the famous murder wasn't the end of him. The demon is part of what's roaring through me now. I'm a predator, leaper, springer, pounder, ripper. I'm a joy of destruction, an ecstatic killing machine. I've never had so much fun. Roar! The machine downshifts. I grimace and stare around in the darkness, baring my teeth. A crocodile at the edge of a river. Joaquin gets up with his mame coco, stands next to me, and for a long time whisks me off with its leaves as I lie there on my belly. He gets back in his hammock, and I hold still, and all is quiet. There's just the breeze in the trees, just the crickets, just the cicadas, just the frogs, just the nightbirds. After a while, Joaquin begins whistling. It sounds weak and effeminate. I mock the tune with my falsetto voice and snicker. Joaquin hisses, "Shh," to shut me up, the same sound he uses on his dogs when they're barking. And, with a mocking laugh, I fall silent. Fred and Claire go for a walk down by the river. Raoul stows his camera and crawls into his sleeping bag. Silent, I brood. The demonic feeling ahead is energy, freedom, bliss. Attacking and killing as a jaguar, one is fully alive in the moment, unfettered by morality. Not seeing oneself as evil, but as obeying one's God-given impulses. In that case, is it really evil? But with the slightest notion of morality, with the slightest awareness of ourselves as members of a cooperative society, we learn to restrain ourselves. Going berserk isn't evil when a jaguar does it, but when a human does, it usually is because we know better. Berserk, it means bear shirt. Vikings visualized going batshit crazy for battle as putting on a bearskin shirt. It's like that thing Joaquin said to me recently about jaguars wanting to turn me into one of them with a jaguar tunic. Ahora aguántalo, Joaquin murmurs to me, como Huarani mismo. Now deal with it like a Huarani. Yeah, I silently concur. The Huaranis are all about dealing with this energy. I flash back to my dream about Noma chatting with Pata while his torso was cut open. I climb back into my hammock, pondering the lives and deaths of wild rainforest people, and the times that they kill, and the times that they refrain from killing. In fact, it can be hard to deal with this energy without submitting to it. Sometimes when someone kills someone, people say he was possessed by a demon, and it's because his mind was running demon energy like a computer program. It can be good for defending the groups we live in. When a threat comes from outside, it lets us protect one another, up to and including killing the invaders. Discrimination is called for. In which situations is demonic ferocity appropriate? My dad was no fighter, and my mom insisted I be peaceful, so I didn't learn violence. Sometimes other kids punched me while I stood there unable to respond. We boys had war movies playing in our heads, imagery left over from World War II and Vietnam. We're a squad of soldiers deep in enemy territory, and our lives are put at risk by the weakest member of our group. Some kids saw me as that weak one and wanted to toughen me up by punching some violence into me. Has the seed they planted finally sprouted? I pray that if it's truly the best solution sometime, I can use violence. I resolve that if it's not, I won't. I ask the highest power in the universe to sustain me in this resolution. Fred and Claire pick their way back into the hut and gently lie down. In the darkness before dawn, everything is cool, calm, quiet. It's as if the air itself is sleeping, and no one wants to wake it. Even our dreams are sleeping. At 8 in the morning, we four outsiders left by motor canoe. With the spray flying around us, I told Raoul over the drone of the motor, that I was sorry I had roared at him. I wasn't really, because I had just been going with the Ihe's flow, and the Ihe had wanted to do that, but apologizing seemed to be the polite thing to do. He answered that he would have defended himself if I had come any closer. He took down my address and promised to mail me photos, though I would never receive anything from him. He seemed unhappy with the whole experience, as if he were having second thoughts about being a photojournalist. While Fred smiled into the sparkling spray from the prow of the canoe, Claire told me that at one point a night bird had been singing close to the hut, and Joaquin had called it with his whistling. In response, it came and perched on the peak of the hut until my noise scared it away.